Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is Melody Brooke. Melody and her husband have written a screenplay titled That's Not How It's Done, addressing the issues about the family court system in crisis. They are now on a mission to encourage divorced parents to take a creative look at how a heart awakening approach can help them find a common ground that will help their children live a happier and more productive life. Melody and I will be discussing about her life's journey and her current project, That's Not How It's Done, the movie. Good morning, Melody. Welcome from My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning. I'm doing great.
Wonderful. I look forward to hearing about your fresh perspective in helping today's blended family. I understand that, of course, you are a blended family and how you guys have dealt with it. And now you have something wonderful to address the number one concern the other blended families have as well. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Wow, that's a big list. I was born in the 50s and to a mom who was very young. And so my parents were divorced when I was 2. My mom remarried when I was 5. And I grew up in Oklahoma City. And I had a sort of chaotic childhood. I didn't learn a lot about relationships myself and ended up, being a child of the 60s and going through all the typical adolescent 60s hippie day stuff and kind of landed in Dallas in the mid-70s and started really finding my way as an actor and as a mother by the time I was 24 and then went through two divorces of my own. And then after my second divorce, scratched my head and went, okay, what's going on here? this is not right. This has got to be something about me. And spent the next few years sort of understanding how I had gotten there. And then when I met my current husband, I had just really discovered my model, which my books are based on. And that model has helped us as a couple be able to survive the blended family situation that we've had because I had 3 daughters and he has a son and a daughter. So we had 5 children between us and both all of us kind of feeling our way through the blended family configuration that we now found ourselves in. And now we have 5 adult children. Well, one's almost an adult. He's still 16, but the rest of them are all grown on their own and happy. And in the meantime, we've dealt with a lot of the situations that our screenplay is about, which is all the difficulties that men have in being able to stay connected to their kids after a divorce.
Going back to your family yourself, as children, we try to emulate our parents. And, of course, you came from a blended family, I presume, after your parents got divorced at a very young age. Does that play an influence in how you view men in a way?
Oh, absolutely it did, and so did my history of some sexual trauma as a child, and those things definitely influenced how I saw men as being distant and difficult and fearful, as fearful for me, objects of fear. And so as a result, I didn't trust men and I was not able to communicate well with men because you can't communicate well with someone that you're afraid of, right? And I think as women, we do sort of have this approach avoidance, experience towards men. And not that men don't have that too, but certainly we have that attitude and that causes some of the difficulties that we have in our relationships.
How did you meet Mike? I mean, obviously the third time is a charm. Was it the third time for him as well, or was it just for you?
Well, that was the second time. He had been married for almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. And we met at a huge charity singles ball in Dallas back in 98. Mm-hmm. And we both of us had this sense that we needed to be at this event, and we both, you know, dressed up in formal wear and went to this dance, and I was kind of moving to the music mix to the dance floor, and he asked me to dance, and the rest is history.
That's wonderful. I mean, it sounds to me like it's love at first sight, so that's wonderful.
Yeah, it kind of was. We, you know, we were both kind of shocked and like, oh my gosh, is this really happening?
Well, that brings us to the challenges that you guys face as blended families. I mean, each family, yours and Mike's, has their own problems, sets of problems, so to speak, and the challenges that you guys are facing with the court system. Please educate us on that.
Well, from my point of view, things were fairly simple in that my ex-husband and I got along fairly well in terms of handling our divorce, and we both kind of agreed as to where the girl should be, and child support was never really that big of an issue. He agreed on the amount from the beginning, and we stuck with that when I never changed it. And you know, I didn't choose to be adversarial about anything, and neither did he, so that worked very well. Mm-hmm. But for Mike and his ex, she continued to be angry and kind of held the kids hostage. And Mike had been sort of the primary caregiver to the kids, and the kids mm-hmm. were, you know, very bonded with him. But the option of blended parenting never really came into play, and the kids suffered for it. They ended up, both of them, dealing with depression, and we tried to at various times get, you know, custody of each of them just to help them through their depressive episodes. And, you know, she fought us the whole way, and it never worked out well for the kids, although, you know, the youngest is still having some difficulties, but the oldest has fared pretty well and remains very connected to her dad. But it's been a very difficult process emotionally for all the kids and for mine.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it's the adult going to war and the children's are the victim.
That's right. That's exactly right. And when the parents cannot separate their anger at their partner with what happens to their kids and realizing and taking ownership of the fact that this is not a good thing for the kids, regardless of what your feelings are about your ex-partner, you know, you have to take into consideration that the impact it's going to have on the kids, or you're really being a perpetrator. You're abusing your children in a way.
How did you guys overcome these challenges?
Well, for us, it's been an ongoing difficult thing, and we just worked at trying to stay connected to the kids, which with Mike's youngest, we haven't been able to do as well as we would like, just because he's pretty well aligned with his mother at this point. But, you know, you give each other support, and you help each other maintain a level head and try to be coming from a compassionate place when you're talking about and dealing with the ex, no matter how badly they may behave.
I understand. What is This Is Not How It's Done all about?
Well, the movie came out of some of Mike's experiences loosely, very loosely, and some of the experiences of a friend of his and some of my clients. And those three stories just, they really needed to be told in terms of understanding the impact that divorce and the manipulations of an ex-spouse and the legal system has on the family, most especially, and in particular on men, because men are generally the ones that are the non-custodial parent.
How is the system stacked against fathers, though?
Well, again, because it's a couple of different things. One is men automatically assume that they cannot or should not attempt to get custody of the kids majority of the time. Obviously, there are exceptions to that. But for a man, it's much more difficult to automatically be given the custody of the kids because our system, you know, sort of flipped back in the 50s, because before the 1950s, men automatically got custody of the children. Did you know that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, yeah. Because they were basically the breadwinner of the family.
Exactly.
And that's where the money is at. And so technically they control everything. I mean, they're able to support,
well,
so to speak.
That and the fact that they could support the children, and the mother couldn't, because at that point, women didn't work that much
right.
outside of the home. So it was a way to provide financial support for the children, and it made sense in a way, except that, you know, then the court started looking at, well, who is the child bonded to? And most of the time it's the mother, and is that fair to the kids? Because that caused damage to the kids to be ripped from the person they're most emotionally bonded to. So then they came up with the idea of child support to help the mother be able to support the children, even if she doesn't have a job outside the home. Well, that's well and good for the time that was, and it was a good thing in terms of helping families, you know, stay connected on an emotional level to their mother. But the difficulty is that today it's a very different world, isn't it? We have more people that, women that work outside the home. Almost, you know, the majority of women do work outside the home now. So it's a whole different world than it was back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have to adjust our court system in accordance with the way the world is today. And, you know, there's as many men that are willing to be, you know, full-time dads as there are women that are willing to be full-time moms. And we've got to allow that is what is in the best interest of the child. And all the studies show that it is in the best interest of the child for them to have 50-50 time with each parent. You know, parents have a difficult time with the idea of, you know, shuffling their kids from one home to the other, but even though that's not always easy, it is always in the best interest of the child. That is, in the cases, I say always, the majority of the time, there are obviously cases where one of the other parent is not a good parent, and in that case, it's a whole different subject.
As a counselor, because you are a licensed marriage and family therapist, what are some of the horror stories that you have encountered?
Oh my gosh, you know, you just wouldn't even believe. you know, the way that some of these men are just completely manipulated by their ex-spouse. And they just kind of have to jump through the hoops. And I've seen them do things, the ex-wives doing things like refusing to allow their husband access to their child, continually giving them reasons, oh, they're sick, oh, they're spending the night with so-and-so, oh, they're, you know, giving them, they don't want to see you today. I mean, just all kinds of reasons, keeping the parent, the non-custodial parent, away from their child with no real reason other than they just, the custodial parent is angry and wants to use the, you know, that child as a weapon against their ex-husband or ex-wife, as the case may be.
You and I have talked about this before we came on the air this morning, and surprisingly enough, let's face the facts now. I mean, we hear a lot about deadbeat dads. I mean, you're talking about how people have to get so creative in the sense that the sheriff's department and whatever family court specialists have game night, and they run out all these people by offering them free tickets and so forth to haul all the deadbeat dads to jail. But you don't actually hear any one of these associations holding a bake sale, you know,
right.
to round up mothers to bring them to justice, so to speak, if there's such a thing. So,
there definitely are deadbeat moms. There definitely are. But they're very less prosecuted than deadbeat dads are.
Okay.
As a culture, we tend to think of women as the victim and men as the perpetrators. We see men as the aggressors and women as the passive one. That's a cultural bias that has nothing to do with reality. The majority of the time, it's 50-50. You know, there's just as many women and men that we're really not that different in terms of how we behave. And, you know, we are the culture very slanted in our view of men and women.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Why is it important to change how men and fathers are viewed?
Well, I think that until we begin to recognize that men have just as much importance in our children's lives as fathers, as we do as mothers. We just play different roles, but we're just as important to the psychological and emotional development of our children as a father as we are as a mother. And we have to change our perception of men in our culture in order for us to accept that view. You know, we tend to automatically knee-jerk reaction of, oh, the kids should be with their mother. I mean, my gosh, it's their mommy. Well, you know, yeah, they need their mommy, but they also need their daddy. And it, you know, it's the same. And until we change our cultural acceptance of that and recognize that importance, then we are going to continue to perpetrate this against our children because it's the children that pay the price.
What needs to change to improve the current climate for men and fathers?
What needs to change is we have to start viewing men differently. You know, if you look at the media, if you watch anything on television, you see that fathers are ridiculed, treated as the butt of jokes, or they are seen as the, you know, just the mean, bad person in the story. And very seldom do we get to see a whole person in viewing men as being the whole people that women are. You know, we can, men are just like women in that they can be sensitive and they can be strong and they can be angry and they can be, you know, everything that women can be, men are. And we don't see that in terms of our perception of men. We tend to view women as the weak, powerless, you know, gosh, and you know that they if they fight, if they kick and they fight, it's because they have a reason, and you know we're not upset when a woman beats on a man. We're like, well, he probably deserves it, right?
Very interesting.
And that's not how we see it, right? We need to shift how mm-hmm. we understand that. You know, no, violence is not okay, no matter who's doing it.
Right, you know? Right. Do you think that that's a generational issue as well? The newer generations now, even though marriages may not work out, but in terms of, for lack of a better term, yeah, this is an old cliche word, you know, who's wearing the pants in the family, has leveled off between the men and the women, say, versus 10, 20, possibly, definitely, for sure, 20 to 30 years ago?
You know, I'd really like to see a study about that. I think intuitively I would say that that's probably accurate, that mm-hmm. younger women today are more liberal in their approach as a whole. I think there's still plenty of places, plenty of pockets in our culture where, you know, the whole idea of men wearing the pants is still alive and well, mm-hmm. Even for the younger generation. But I think as a whole, you may be right that it could be starting to shift. And I certainly hope so, because it benefits everyone.
What I could see based on the things that I've seen outside, interaction out there, again, men tend to get the bad rap about being date beats and so forth. And then at the same time, in the divorce situation, the man can't wait and say, oh, I don't want any responsibility so that I can be single, no baggage kind of thing. I'd rather just, you know, be on my own.
Well, you know, there are men and women both that have that sort of mm-hmm. feeling. But I think that men will more likely go to that because it's really their only option, because they're not going to have access to their kids, so they might as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, until we change how we perceive and teach our men, you know, for one thing, is
right.
when a man has been raised in a household where the men are marginalized, where fathers are marginalized, they expect that for themselves. So naturally, they just and often even in the younger women, I've seen it where the dads are pushed out of the role as a father. They're really marginalized. The mothers, I think you probably have seen it too, where the mother just says, no, I can do it better.
Right.
And just kind of taking over and pushing the man out and not giving them an opportunity to develop their own style as a parent, because the woman just assumes she can do it better. That happens in younger families as well as in older ones. But I think that's a part of it, is helping men to change how they perceive of their value in the home, starting with, you know, from the time their child is born, you know, doing the sharing the diapering and the feeding and the caring as much as the mom does. And if they do that, by the time they do end up getting divorced, then they'll know that they have an important role in their children's lives, and there won't be so much of this moving out and just seeing that as not their responsibility.
See, the men's club should be calling you up to give you the award for the year for standing up for them.
I just wanted to help us make this film, that's all.
I understand. what you're doing is great. I think you're right, because there's always two sides of the equation. And sometimes we don't see the other side because we tend to just hear what's news that's available to us. So how can we go about in making these changes to help men be recognized as not necessarily the bad guys all the time?
I think we have to do a lot of educating ourselves and educating people around us, and recognizing that if they have that automatic assumption that women are the better caretakers, challenge that. You know, when you hear people making those comments, when you hear people making those assumptions, challenge it a little bit. Say, well, you know, why do you think that? And let's talk about this, and open that discussion up and get people to start thinking differently about their assumptions. Because it's those assumptions that our court systems are based on. And we can change some of those assumptions through how we portray men in the media, starting to change, you know, the commercials that are making men a joke, that make fathers a joke, the sitcoms that make fathers a joke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, changing the view of fathers in the media so that we can see men and fathers as being both sensitive and nurturing and strong at the same time.
The show that came to mind is Two and a Half Men, because you have both sides of the equation within the same sitcom. You have this wonderful character of being a caring father to a fault in some ways.
Yes, but he's also ridiculed. He's also the butt of jokes.
Right. And at the same time, you have this macho side, the alter ego in the brother, who technically people tend to associate with as being, that's, there you go, that's that typical man, that's how they act.
Right. And you see, that's a really good example, because of the fact that it shows how we ridicule the men who try to be fathers and try to be good to their kids, right? That's mm-hmm. the Alan character.
Right.
You know, he's looked at as being ridiculous, and yet he's a good dad. He's paying his mm-hmm. child support. He's, you know, taking his kids when he can. He's taking responsibility for his son. He's doing everything right, but he's mm-hmm. the butt of jokes. Everybody sees him as being ridiculous.
Well, he's weak. He's weak from that macho standpoint of it. Well, you got a weakling here.
Yes. And then you have Charlie, who is the opposite of that, who is Mr. Macho, but he's also a jerk.
Right.
And that's pretty much how we view men, and that's why that show's so popular, because this is the way we have, the icons that we have
right.
for the way men are is, you know, either they're Alan or they're a Charlie, you know? And I'm sorry, most of the men I know are not one or the other. They're, you know, they hopefully are a little bit of both, you know?
Mm-hmm. I understand. One of the very interesting things that you just mentioned just now about white versus, say, other races, because me being Asian, I've heard horror stories about the Asian man being the domineering one and fabricate stories in all kinds of situations to just to get their way. So it's a very tough deal, because when you're dealing with divorce situations and you're dealing with men and women, have you ever encountered that in your session with regards to the cultural-wise in terms of white, African-American, Asian, uh-huh. and so forth? Because I'm Asian, and I've heard some horror stories about the women, in all actuality, need to be protected because the man comes across so strong. And I've heard in one particular situation that I knew from a friend of a friend, and this is a true story, where when the wife actually had started dating, the husband fabricated the story about the wife's boyfriend was molesting his son. The husband came up with all this story simply because to get involved into this little battle that you talk about, you know, cost.
Yeah, that kind of parental alienation and aggression
yeah.
happens on both sides. Men and women both do it. And
yeah.
it's the children that pay the price.
That's
and
right.
We have to change this adversarial system. And, you know, I think that comes from that inability for people to be able to adjust to the change. And it is hard, and there's feelings involved, and you know, they need to seek out some counseling to help them manage their hurt and their anger so that it doesn't end up being, the price doesn't end up getting paid by the children.
Mm-hmm. Well, what component of the system currently right now is working right?
I think the system is completely broken. I don't see mm-hmm. Any way that it's working in the interest of the children, because the system is not set up to work for the best interest of the child, even though that is what they are supposedly called upon to do.
Right.
They are really the way the system is set up is to benefit the system. We have child support as being the only real criteria, is who can provide the most child support. And because each of the states, each of the courts are, I don't know if you've spoken with, there's a judge, I'm not going to remember her name, out of New Hampshire, that talked about the fact that our court systems are rewarded for the amount of child support that they can enforce during the during a year. And so the more they get more grants based on the child support they're able to bring in. So the whole system is based on the amount of child support. It's not based on what's in the best interest of the child. And that is a broken system, because we have to recognize that, in fact, the best, by far the best arrangement for a child would be 50-50 custody with both parents, and either both parents paying child support or neither parent paying child support, depending on the circumstances.
Very interesting. How will your film contribute to making the entire system better?
Well, what we hope to do is begin to have people look at how men are a little differently, to be able to see men as the way I have seen them in my life, which is both masculine and sensitive, both able to provide nurturing to their children and to provide that that protection that we want from our men, so that we can see men as a whole and in the role of father as being more important than what we currently do in our culture. And making that shift is what the film's about, being able to have a little bit more compassionate view of men and families.
Where can someone go to get more information about the movie you're making and help out basically with the project and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, you can go to our website, which is thatsnothowitsdone.com. And from the website, you're can then link to the Kickstarter campaign to see a little teaser. And if you wanted to support the film, you can donate anywhere from $10 to $10,000 or whatever you want to help make the film happen, or just keep up with what we're doing with the film. And you can see a little bit about our background, about the storyline of the film, and really get a better sense of what it is that we're doing by going to thatsnothowitsdone.com.
Who is the brainchild for this film? How did it come about?
Well, what happened was that we were dealing with some particularly frustrating issues with my husband and his son, and so that was really on my mind. And one day I was driving home from seeing a client, and I had a thought that these three stories of these three sort of conglomerate characters would make a great screenplay. And I came home and I told Mike, and he was at this particularly boring job at the time and was looking for a creative outlet, and he jumped on the idea. So we sat down over the course of about 3 or 4 weeks and wrote out the script.
I understand that you managed to get some local actors to be involved with the project as well.
Yeah, the local actors were basically friends of mine, people that I knew, who I wanted to invite to play with, and they got to our house, and basically one day we shot this little teaser to give people an idea of what it is we're doing with the film. And they're all Dallas actors, all local Dallas actors, including myself. I have a small role in it.
Very interesting. What would you like your viewers to gain from watching That's Not How It's Done?
I want them to see that that the system doesn't work, that how it's done today does not work, and that we have to begin to make some changes if we want to benefit our children and our families and make all of us stronger. Then, you know, that watching the film will help perhaps motivate people to see the world a little differently and see men and families a little bit differently.
And how much money are y'all needing to raise for this project?
Well, the Kickstarter campaign is $120,000, which is bare bones. Obviously, that's not going to get us any stars, but it does get us to the point where we can make the film, and then we need to raise additional funds to pay for stars, or if we wanted to promote it and take it to the next level. But that gets us started.
Wonderful. As a licensed marriage counselor, as I mentioned before, you are a licensed marriage counselor and family counselor, and pretty much now you've been married for 12 years. How do you keep the marital bliss going?
Well, we do it by having a lot of compassion for each other. I wrote, and I think I mentioned earlier that right before we met, I came up with my model. Mm-hmm. And my model is called Cycles of the Heart, which talks about how our primitive brain responses set us up to feel like we're adversaries with our partner, and that we can learn to be compassionate for each other once we understand that pattern that happens automatically in our brains and how we can sort of interfere with that and take ownership of our own behaviors and feelings and offer our partner respect and have empathy for them. Gosh, you wouldn't believe the number of people I have come in my practice that, you know, want to work out their marriage, but they have absolutely no respect or empathy for each other.
How interesting. That's really
the key, is to be able to develop empathy and respect and take ownership of our own feelings and behaviors as a way to make a relationship work. Without that, you don't make it.
How has writing your screenplay impacted you personally?
Well, you know, I guess it's really opened my eyes even more to how important it is to change our system. And, it's like I've known the system was broken, but the more I talk to people, the more I understand the pain and the anguish. And it's even, in fact, helped me to see how the child support system itself is broken. I mean, I've been divorced twice, and I collected child support once of this whole house anyway. But now I begin to see that it's really an unfair system, which I hadn't really gotten clearly about as I am now. And that doesn't mean that there aren't times when it shouldn't be in place, but that there are so many states in which the child support is just prohibitive in terms of the amount that they charge people, and they really have no regard for the impact that's going to have on the man and his future family. You know, if he goes on and tries to have another life, he can't in many cases. It's why you hear of these cases of men just giving up and burning themselves on the, you know, court steps, or killing themselves and killing their kids, and all kinds of horror stories that happen out of people becoming desperate because they have no way to do the things that the court is requiring them to do.
On the flip side, though, I mean, you have a lot of fathers who don't really care. I mean, who really are out for themselves. They don't look at the other side of the fence, the child, the mother, as a sort of a responsibility kind of thing. They just don't care. And how do you address those kind of issues?
Well, you know, obviously there are deadbeats on women and men that are deadbeats. It's more often than men, just because more often it's the women that end up with the custody. But again, we have to change how we raise our boys to think about their role as fathers. You know, I remember when my daughter was young, and a friend of hers was turning two, and I gave this, he was a little boy, and I gave him a doll that was a boy doll. That was to help him learn how to lace and zip and tie and all that kind of thing. And his father said, my son will not have a doll, and he would not allow him to have the doll. And, you know, that to me was a symptom of why does we have such a difficult, men have such a difficult time thinking of themselves as fathers. Because from a very early age, mommies, you know, little girls are mommies and dads are something else. You know, they're not really raised to be dads, and we have to change that.
We talked about this once before, about the generational gap, because about 20 to 30 years ago, you do have men have the man cave, which is the garage or whatever,
right.
And the women have the kitchen. However, I think now it's pretty much blended. So you do have couples that enjoy cooking, sharing chores and everything else, and in so many ways, it actually breaks down that side of the equation for the men, because men tend to be a lot more sensitive, a lot more caring. And in some ways, because of economics, there are more men who are playing Mr. Mom than ever before. And so I've done some shows to whereby the children are actually running to the men, the father, so to speak, whenever they have problems, because they feel the stronger connection of the two.
Yes, and the difficulty is for those men, and I will say that's true what happened with my husband, because they, you know, his kids were like that with him. But once there was a divorce, The kids still went to the mom.
And what causes that, though? I mean, is there some is it something a natural tendency, or is it something that the dad did something?
I say it's because that's the way our system is designed to work. The majority of the time, the kids automatically go to the mom. And the court, you know, for a dad to get custody, they have to fight for it. And even then, they have an uphill battle. It's a lot more difficult for dads to have that custody, even if they're the primary caregiver for the child. I think that's really a systemic problem that we're going to have to start, looking more specifically. The problem is that the numbers are so high. We have so many people getting divorced, so many people getting married, so many, that the court doesn't want to have to get involved in figuring out who is the best parent. So we have to change the way the court system is devised. And I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I just know that the system that we have doesn't work.
The Pew Research Center out in Washington, D.C., that does demographic studies and so forth, in March of this year came up with a very interesting information. For the first time, they showed that the millennial generation, that is, generations that were born after 1980, view that being a good parent is far more important in having a wonderful relationship, because they realize that relationships may not work. However, once you are a parent, then you're obligated for life, so to speak, and want to be a very good parent to the child.
Yeah, and we have to begin to look at our role as a parent as being a permanent role, and I think largely men are not raised to believe that is their job, that's really the mother's job to parent, and that is changing as you've observed that is changing, I think. Mm-hmm. But as the legal system hasn't really reflected that.
What would the things that you like to see the legal system do or change in this case to balance the equation?
Well, I think to begin with, it has to follow the recommendation of the federal court, which is that unless there's a prevailing reason to do otherwise, that there should be 50-50 custodial possession of the children for each parent. That is in the best interest of the child, unless there's some prevailing, overriding reason not to. For instance, if there's abuse or violence.
Is there any other thing that, besides that, that?
I think we have to reevaluate the child support system and change how we reward our family court systems. You know, when the family courts are rewarded for how much child support that they get, then their emphasis is going to be on the amount of child support they can get, not the best interest of the child, which is the most important thing that they're supposed to be doing. I think if we change those two things, then a lot of the problems that we have would go away. And the other thing would be to have mandatory counseling for couples who have that kind of adversarial relationship.
You must have a lot of men that come see you, huh?
Yes, I do, actually. And it's funny because even before I was involved in this sort of men's rights movement, the majority of the time it was the husbands that called me, which for therapy, which always surprised me. But that's still true. It's always been true.
How does women view you then?
I get along great with women. I have lots of women in my practice, probably more than men. I think that because it's a compassionate position for everyone, they come in and it's not an adversarial situation. It's not an either or. It's okay, let's look at what's going to be in the best situation for both of you. And, helping, because in reality, if we as women change how we perceive men, then we're going to get more of what we want in our relationship, both as a divorced person and as a marriage partner. We're going to get more of what we want and what we really need if we are able to be compassionate with each other, and if we are able to see men as, giving them a chance to really be more of a partner in our lives. It's going to benefit us. It's going to benefit our kids. It's going to benefit the culture at large.
Very true. I got two questions for you, but I'm going to ask question one first.
Okay.
What encouraging message do you have for parents and children who are currently going through their challenging process right now? Pretty much, they filed the papers for divorce, What encouraging message do you have for them?
I would say the most important thing is just to remember that the most important thing is not who's right and who's wrong. The most important thing is how well your kids are going to do in the end. Focusing on what's good for your kids. Even if you think, you know, he's not the greatest parent in the world, it doesn't really matter. What does matter is that your kids have a relationship with their dad, with their mother, that is solid and bonded and connected, and that will help them through a lot more than any kind of alienation ever would.
And this is based on, of course, the normal equation here, barring from any abusive tendencies and so forth from either party, correct?
Well, you know, even if there's abuse on one side or the other, it doesn't mean that that person is not an important person in your child's life. Obviously, there would have to be very strong limits around around mm-hmm. the contact, but you know that person will always play an important role in the psychological emotional development of the child. And so, the better, the healthier that relationship can be, the better it is for the child. Even in the cases of where there's abuse, if the child can develop some kind of a understanding of what's going on with their parent and have some kind of a connection with them, it'll help them in the long run. And I'm not saying necessarily live with them, but
to
have a relationship with them is important.
I'm at loss in the sense that I'm looking at children are looking at their parents to almost mimic or emulate tendencies, and we hope to God that they're looking at the good tendencies, good habits, so to speak. So
yeah,
if you have someone that grows up, you know, in a situation where the whether it's the mother who is the one that's aggressive or the father, it doesn't matter,
mm-hmm.
then they
right.
will take that with them as part of their process, so to speak.
Yes, that's right. And unless they get a lot of counseling to help them learn a different way to understand, and if the other parent is not you know, it's funny because if the abuse is one of the parents is abusive and the other is not, then completely alienating the abusive parent doesn't really get them what they want, because then mm-hmm. the child feels rejected. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
Because the child knows that they are part of that parent, that they came from that parent.
Right.
So it's a difficult thing, but if you alienate that, even if the parent is abusive, if you alienate that parent, then you are sort of alienating your own child, which you don't want to do. Instead, if you can develop a compassionate view of that abusive parent, doesn't mean that you give them free access to your child, but mm-hmm. if you help them to develop a compassionate view of that parent so that they recognize that while this parent's behaving badly, it probably is that this person has had really terrible things happen to them in their life, and that they can't help it, and you know that they need help, or whatever. You know, have a compassionate view so that you're not rejecting your child outright.
Okay. The next question is, before we even get to that point,
uh-huh.
and you're a marriage counselor, you're a family counselor, what are some of the tips that people need to be mindful about when they get married and obviously having children? And we talk about the 7-year itch, which happens to be now the 3-year itch or something like that.
Right.
So as an expert, tell us what we can do.
Well, to begin with, you have to recognize that we go into marriage having, you know, this whole expectation of being taken care of, and once we get married, and we expect our partner to make us happy. And when we get married, of course, you realize, I think probably you realize, that most of us, well, we, you know, another person cannot make us happy.
Mm-hmm.
So we take with us all of our experiences from our past into that marriage, and then we expect our partner to make us happy. Well, that's not going to happen. And so then we feel disappointed, and mm-hmm. we blame it to our partner for our disappointment. So if we can go into the marriage from a point of view of being curious and open and compassionate, and developing the ability to be compassionate with our partner and having that respect and empathy going into it, then whenever the conflicts come up, we can have a completely different way of responding to each other in this conflict. We end up not being each other's enemy, but being curious and open and interested when there's a conflict, which is a very difficult skill to manage, but it's really important. And of course, I'm gonna say, I think you got to get my book, which is called Oh Wow, This Changes Everything, mm-hmm. which you can get on Amazon, to help understand that whole process.
And let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, do you have any part of that book that addressed issues with children itself and helping to deal with the process?
I think, again, it's about compassion. When we are in that old brain reactivity, that survival mode that we get into, especially in the context of conflicts between partners, we tend to feel our survival is threatened, right? So we move mm-hmm. into those survival impulses and move into our survival reflexes, which really generally fall into three categories. We either lay down and perceive ourselves as the victim and mm-hmm. All is hopeless and despairing, or we move into attack mode, which is the sort of self-protective mode of mm-hmm. I'm going to get you before you get me, or you move into what's called the rescuer position, which is, let me see if I can fix it. What do I have to do to make it better? And placating, right? Those mm-hmm. are our three automatic reactions that we have when we get into a situation where we feel threatened. And there isn't much that feels more threatening than a divorce. So if we can recognize those impulses and recognize that is not necessarily how we have to behave, but our instinct is to behave that way, and if we can learn how we react and what our reactions are and develop an understanding of the opposite way. So if we're a person who tends to lay down and just give up, then what we have to do is we have to learn to take ownership of our and responsibility for our lives and what's happening in the moment. If we are a person who moves into that self-protective, I'll get you before you get me standpoint, mm-hmm. if instead of doing that, we could consciously work at developing empathy for mm-hmm. our partner. If we are the person who tries to run in and just fix everything and make everything better, we could mm-hmm. recognize that what we have to do is be respectful of ourselves and of our children and of our ex-partners. Mm-hmm. Then those are the three things that will begin to move us out of that sort of egocentric, one against all point of view into a more compassionate place.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Do you have at any time spent time speaking to children and getting their point of view about the situation, about the family, in crisis?
You know, kids, all they really want is their parents to be married and live together.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
That's really all they want. And right. A lot of times, kids will continue to fantasize that their parents will get back together long into their adulthood. They really, really just secretly wish their parents would be back together because that would give them a sense that all is right in the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, that said, if their parents can get along and be friends with each other, that's the next best thing because then they get to see their parents. I've heard so many kids just, with tears in their eyes say, oh, my gosh, I actually sat down at the dinner table with both of my parents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What it means to them to have parents who get along is huge. So the more that we can provide our children with that safety and security of having both of their parents in their lives and recognize it being okay, then the kids feel like they're okay and the world is safe.
That's a good point. What can we expect from you from the second half of this year?
Well, the second half of this year, I will be putting together the film, the pre-production for the film, and getting the film underway in terms of the filming, hopefully by the end of the year.
Okay. Any other things that you are working on besides the film itself? Are you involved with other projects?
It's interesting. The other projects, obviously, are my books and getting them out. And then thirdly, Mike is a programmer. And while we were working on shooting our teaser, he came up with a web-based system for managing productions. Mm-hmm. And now we're at beta testing a web-based program, which is brilliant in terms of organizing pre-production and production of films. And we're going to be making that available for other producers at some point. So that's our other project, yeah.
Fantastic. Coming back to Mike and you, one of the things that I know that you guys wrote this screenplay is when y'all were having all this tremendous amount of frustration and so forth. So as a counselor, you understand that, and you put things down on paper. It's a process of cleansing in some ways. How has this been good for you guys, for you two?
Well, it's interesting because part of what it's done is it's helped, I think, Mike kind of wrap everything up in a package that he experienced and be able to maybe put some of it behind him.
Mm-hmm.
Because it has been so extremely painful for him, and to be able to, you know, kind of package it up and say, okay, this is the story. Even though I have to say it wasn't the events that he experienced.
Sure, yeah.
It wasn't exactly that, but on an emotional level, it was. And so it kind of helped him, I think, to put a to kind of wrap it up and put closure on it for him. And that, for me, has offered me some relief in that, you know, in helping him do that.
Well, it certainly offers you guys a fresh perspective in terms of how the situation is and how you guys were able to overcome it and make the very best situation works out for everyone concerned in so many ways. So that's wonderful.
I have to say it also sort of gives some meaning to it. You know, when you have a loss, when you have some tragedy in your life, and if you can create some meaning in it, sometimes that helps to relieve some of the pain. And I'd say that's probably part of this also.
Wonderful. We're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
It's going to be basically one of taking that compassionate point of view. My phrase that I like to use is, we are mm-hmm. all doing the best we can. And what that really means is, yeah, there are people who behave badly. Yeah, there are people who act in ways you certainly wish that they hadn't. Even ourselves sometimes mm-hmm. we act in ways that we wish we hadn't. But if we can be compassionate for ourselves and for other people, we'll recognize that in that moment, we are doing the best we can given the information and the situation that we're in. You know, all of us are in situations from time to time that we don't behave the best that we could have, or in retrospect. But at that moment, it was really the only way we could do it. It was the only choice that we had. And if we can view ourselves and other people from that perspective, then it allows us to be more compassionate with them and, you know, be more loving in how we respond. And, you know, having that view, even when we're talking about people who are abusive and do violent things, it doesn't mean we don't still need protection from those people, but it allows us to let go of the hatred and the rage and be more compassionate with them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it gives us peace in a way that nothing else can.
That's wonderful. That's beautiful. We talk about horror stories, so let's talk about some of the wonderful, successful stories that you've heard once you level the equation, so to speak. What other wonderful stories have you heard out there where people have a wonderful consensus about the children comes first?
You know, what you see when that happens is that you see there's a beautiful experience of both the spouse and ex-spouse getting along and the new partners getting along. Like in my case with my ex-husband and his wife and my husband and the four of us, we've gone out to dinner together. We've had parties for the kids together, and the kids feel way, way, way more secure and happy. And it's great when that happens. And it's really the ideal that is not impossible for people. And I know it's hard when you're thinking about how bitter a divorce is and how angry you are at your partner to imagine that you could ever be in that situation. But when you put your love for your child first, when mm-hmm. you see the child, you know, needs as more important than anything that's going on between you and your partner, then you can come from a compassionate place and change how you how your lives are, you know, from that point forward. And no matter how bad it's been in the past, you can make the decision to be compassionate and move forward in a compassionate way from this point on.
Wonderful. Please give us your website again, all the information about this wonderful movie that you guys are making.
It's thatsnothowitsdone.com.
Is there any other websites that you would like them to go to?
Yeah, if you're interested in knowing more about me or about my books, you can go to awakenedheartproductions.com.
It's awakenedheartproductions.com.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Or you can just Google me because I'm all over the web. So.
That's wonderful. For sure, I'm saying that the guys have to be championing your side of the equation, you know, since you are championing them. So this is a wonderful work that you're doing. Melody, thank you for the great recipes for living that you have shared with us just now and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guests will be Marie Christ and Pamela Wright. Marie and her mother, Pamela, are both children's advocates. They are authors with their own powerful book series. For Marie, it is The Citizen Chronicles, and for Pamela, it is Justifiable Series. Marie, Pamela, and I will be discussing about their life's work in bringing awareness to child abuse and modern-day slavery. For additional information about this show, future shows, and to receive a free recipe for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. Melody, thank you again. Keep up the good work and have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.